Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I think we'll make a start, and then others can join us if they wish. So I'm delighted to introduce Professor J. Cullen from the University of Sheffield. J. is a reader in banking law and financial regulation. I think that's your title at Sheffield. Something like that. J. is, as well as that, he's also director of the Sheffield Institute for Corporate and Commercial Law. His principal area of expertise is bank capital and liquidity regulation and the effects of bank credit on real estate markets. He's also written on bankers' compensation and bank corporate governance, and is the author of the book Executive Compensation in Imperfect Financial Markets, which he published with Edward Elgar in 2014. Dr. Cullen's work on bank leverage and corporate governance has been quoted by the Financial Times, the Bank of England and the European Commission. He's also acted as a consultant to NGOs on EU financial regulation and is an associated expert at the Institute for New Economic Thinking and Finance Watch. As well as his position at Sheffield, Dr. Cullen has held visiting positions at Columbia University and the University of Oslo. And since it's the 10-year anniversary of the global financial crisis and associated banking collapses, it's a particularly apt time to be addressing this topic this afternoon, which is the case for abolishing deposit insurance limits. So, over to Jake.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, everyone, for the invitation to speak here. So this paper, this is the first time I've ever presented this paper anywhere. It's a working paper, obviously, and this is just a very rough draft. I don't even have a fully working draft yet, so I suppose the message is, if you can give me some feedback, whether you like the paper or not would be good. But any feedback you can give me on specifics would be most useful. So I understand that thinking about abolition of deposit insurance limits fills a lot of people with dread. The idea that bank deposits or bank liabilities ought to be insured in some way has been cited many times, both in the literature and in regulatory reports, as a prime mover in the financial crisis. Obviously, in terms of the economics literature, there's an awful lot of many papers on moral hazard and the poor incentives that guaranteeing bank liabilities generate. And this proposal that I will outline in the paper shortly may be controversial and be viewed as radical. And my view is that actually it's not radical at all when we consider the real state of financial regulation or banking regulation in both. I mean, I tend to concentrate on the US and the UK in this analysis. But I think that although on its face it appears radical, it's actually not. And it simply recognises the fact that there are de facto guarantees of bank liabilities provided by treasuries and central banks across various economies. So the aim of the paper, this is a quote that I take from a guy called Warren Mosler. Has anybody heard of Warren Mosler? Anyone heard of modern monetary theory? No? Okay, so it's a fairly it's a growing theory in economics, particularly in the United States, but it's gaining traction in the UK. And Warren Mosler is one of the proponents of modern monetary theory. Stephanie Kelton, who was the chief economist to Bernie Sanders in the previous election, presidential primaries, and she is an adherent of modern monetary theory, and one of her sort of intellectual forebears is Warren Mosler. And he argues that the hard lesson of banking history is that the liability side of banking is not the place for market discipline. In other words, efforts to regulate banking by concentrating on the liability side of bank balance sheets are always doomed to failure, partially because there is an unacknowledged yet implicit guarantee of those bank liabilities. And virtually every banking crisis that one can think of over the past 30 or 40 years has involved liabilities or the guaranteeing of bank liabilities by the state. And as I'll draw out today, much of the rationale for this is that these liabilities have actually grown beyond the banking system. So the traditional banking system, the retail banking system, creates liabilities which are tradable at par between members of, you know, between retail members of society, corporations, individuals, etc. But what's happened over the past 25, 30 years is that the rise of shadow banking has occurred, and the liabilities of shadow banks are also now have to be de facto guaranteed simply because of their size. And my proposal, which I will outline shortly, is to try to ensure that retail liabilities are guaranteed, and that as a side effect or as a knock-on effect ought to shrink the need for shadow banking liabilities, and that's the thrust of this proposal. There are other layers to it which I'll outline, but that's the main aim. So the aim of the paper is to contextualise the rationale for deposit insurance and to explore and explain the flaws of deposit guarantee schemes, to offer a radical proposal for reform. And I will state now that my proposal for reform is that the deposit guarantee system, as suggested by the title of this presentation, is extended to all retail bank liabilities, or certainly all deposits. And, of course, in going through this, recognising the trade-offs that this will create, I'm not denying that there aren't costs to this sort of proposal, but in my view, the benefits outweigh the flaw or outweigh the costs. So one important point to understand at this juncture is to recognise that the emergence of the shadow banking system and, in fact, the importance or the relative diminishing of the importance of bank deposits has legal origins. The legal origins, as outlined by Gorton and Metrick, who are two financial economists, not lawyers, but they argue that it was legal reform which produced the system that we have now, where we have a system whereby you have a fairly large retail banking system, a fairly large shadow banking system, and the liabilities of the retail banking system are to some degree guaranteed. They're not all guaranteed, but there are guarantees in place, at least explicit guarantees. On the other side, we have liabilities of the shadow banking system, so non-bank financial institutions, which enjoy no guarantees whatsoever. And in fact, in the United States, and to an extent in the UK, legal reforms since 2008, since the big one, as we know it, the big crisis, have actually been introduced to reduce the liability of the state for these liabilities that banks and other financial institutions create. My view is that this is, I'm not saying it's wrong-headed, but there are more efficient ways of preserving stability and reducing the propensity for shadow banking to encroach in terms of credit origination, etc. And you know, this is quite telling, as I say, and as I'll explain in the rest of the presentation. Some of the main reasons, the main drivers of the emergence of the shadow banking system are legal reforms to restrict the traditional and retail banking systems. And in my view, they are Well, they've produced, at least in some ways, the events that we witnessed in the run up to 2008, and in my view, the suboptimal response to those events since the crisis. So the point is, the nature of our financial system is not accidental. It's been shaped by legal and regulatory changes, in particular the growth of non-bank financial institutions, which have grown to be some of the largest financial institutions in the world, has been accelerated by legal change. So at first blush, it might seem that guaranteeing the deposits of retail banks or commercial banks is a massive giveaway to financial institutions. But if you take a holistic view of the issue, in my view, it isn't. And this, you know, the idea that the banking system or the banking system does not enjoy implicit guarantees already is fallacious. Paper after paper in the literature acknowledge the fact, and this was demonstrated in 2008, 9 and 10, that the financial system, in whatever form the liabilities take, is backstopped by government or by the state. And all my proposal does is seek to formalise that some liabilities of a particular form will be honoured in full. Minsky and Campbell, so Hyman Minsky, who's a big intellectual influence upon me, argue this in 1987 after the savings and loan crisis. I won't read it all, of course, but they acknowledge that a system-wide decline in asset values cannot be contained by a guarantee or bailout of some restricted class of deposits or institutions. If instabilities that can generate large system-wide losses of output, employment and asset values are to be contained, more than deposit insurance is needed. Now, I interpret that as more than limited deposit insurance is needed, because what they argue slightly further on is that a stability-enhancing response would be for Congress to accept that it has an open-ended contingent liability and to set in place a well-funded institutional structure that to fulfil its obligations. Most economists and regulators believe that lender of last resort facilities are sufficient to fulfil that role. My view is that it's much simpler to simply institute a blanket guarantee of deposits. So what is a deposit insurance scheme? Well, it's a scheme overseen by a government agency or central bank or treasury, which guarantees normally retail deposits up to a certain limit. In the 1960s, only the US had a scheme. Obviously, they instituted a scheme in the 1930s following the Great Depression and the creation of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. By the 70s, we had 12. Early 2013, it was 93, and by this year, it's 107. So this system of insuring retail or commercial bank liabilities is becoming increasingly prevalent. So the harsh reality is that government already stands behind the banking system. The fact that this is an implicit rather than explicit guarantee means that suggested legal reforms, which are currently regarded as radical, such as the one I will forward today, are discarded, and they will bring real financial benefits without actually altering the way that banks work. So where are we now? Well, as I say, the systems have increased in coverage, and the rationale for deposit insurance schemes is obviously to prevent runs. The Financial Services Authority, before it was abolished, admitted in the aftermath of 2008 that a US style of depositor protection would have undoubtedly been of real help in preventing the retail run on Northern Rock. In the absence of funding guarantees, runs on individual institutions may become contagious, leading to systemic crisis, and of course that can pull the entire banking system down. This was explained in a seminal paper by Diamond and Dittvig in 1983. And of course, they recognise that the bank funding model, whereby their liabilities are very short term, and their assets are generally long term, mean that they are exposed to liquidity pressures. Because if too many people at one point come to them demanding their, you know, their money back, their loan to the bank back, at the same time, then they cannot possibly fulfill it. So a system of deposit insurance is required to maintain stability. And we've seen this frequently. Although there's, you know, Northern Rock was the first fully fledged retail deposit run in this country since the 1800s. There have been plenty of runs on the liabilities of other financial institutions in financial markets, and of course that was the main precipitating factor in 2008. Well, started in 2007 with Northern Rock and bled into 2008. So there are several economic benefits to deposit guarantee schemes. I won't go through them all, of course. Hopefully you're familiar with them, but banks are the main source of finance in most economies, the United States being perhaps the exception, but in all other economies, banks are the major source of liquidity, and disruption to their operations causes recession or unemployment. Bank failures threaten the payment system. So the entire payment system is predicated upon a well-functioning banking system. There are also indirect benefits to deposit guarantee schemes. The first is that there's reduced regulatory forbearance. So regulators are not keen on closing down banks. It's not something that they wish to do wherever they can avoid it. And again, that was seen in 2007 and 8. Most banks were kept on life support, even though they were arguably insolvent, certainly illiquid. So allowing insolvent banks to continue to operate can generate large economic losses, as such banks have incentives to gamble for resurrection. In other words, to do anything to stay afloat, which normally means taking excessive risks, because regulators are not keen to close them down when they should. There are increased incentives for regulatory monitoring because public funds are at risk. So regulators know that the insurance scheme is on the hook for any bank losses, so they monitor to a greater extent. Other indirect benefits include increased competition in several dimensions, because without deposit insurance, savers are likely to migrate to the largest banks, because they perceive them as being safer and less vulnerable to collapse. And therefore, having a deposit insurance scheme encourages more depositors to go to smaller banks. And finally, this is a key plank of this paper at least, is that they reduce the reliance on runnable liabilities or banking structures. Northern Rock, which was the poster child of bad banking, if you like, relied increasingly on very, very short-term and very flaky forms of funding. So deposit guarantee schemes at least should sort of alleviate some of the pressures or incentivize banks not to rely on such short-term sources. So the current law is that at the moment in the UK, we have the guarantee is €100,000. The UK equivalent is £85,000. You probably had letters in the post recently, anyone with a UK bank account, to tell you that the limit increased from £75,000 to £85,000. Simply because of the collapse in the value of sterling in relation to the euro following the Brexit vote. So it used to be 75,000, it's now 85,000. That excludes temporary high balances. But the mechanics of this are not really the point of this. Now, of course, in the literature, which is dominated by economists, which is fine, the debate is generally pointed towards removing deposit guarantee schemes. partially or at all. This is a headline in the Telegraph from 2016 when the Centre for Policy Studies argued that all guarantees for savers deposits ought to be scrapped, which is based on two certainly theoretically sound principles. So moral arguments: in a system of capitalism, as banks are private enterprises, they ought to be able to fail like any other company. We heard this consistently during the after the financial crisis. Just let them fail. They've taken risks which they can't absorb. The shareholders were in charge of the board, if you like. You know, certainly they appointed the board. The board oversaw the risks. They failed. Let them take their medicine. And secondly, and more relevant to this paper, is that there are economic and legal arguments, which is that insuring deposits creates moral hazard, incentivising excessive risk-taking and free-riding on public guarantees. This is a typical enunciation of that view. So the existence of deposit insurance guarantees that depositors will get their money back should the bank fails. This creates incentive distortions, which are twofold. First, deposit insurance gives insured banks incentives to take on riskier investments, since profits from higher risk taking are privately captured by the bank, but losses are socialised. This is Mervyn King. To an extent, banks are international in life and national in death. Losses are always socialised. And second, since depositors are protected when a bank fails, their incentive to monitor the financial condition of their bank is significantly reduced. So they're the two aspects of moral hazard. Especially the second point I would take a lot of issue with, especially because in view of what I said at the beginning, almost all retail bank liabilities are de facto guaranteed anyway. So the idea that retail depositors are not going to monitor banking institutions, but even those above the cap have limited de facto incentives to do so. They know the government stands behind these banks, and I'm not even sure that they have the capacity to do so, which is something that I'll come on to shortly. So Ed Kane, who is until recently was a visiting professor at the University of Sheffield, who I know quite well, would probably hate this paper. He studied deposit insurance for many years, and argues that, you know, at least the third point he makes, mostly dismissed or denigrated by policymakers, but long recognised and persistently emphasised by the academics, is the fact that explicit deposit insurance has the potential to increase bank risk taking because of this moral hazard argument. Now, my view is that it's a more nuanced picture, and I claim that it's a more nuanced picture, partly because in the literature it's already acknowledged that almost all banking liabilities are guaranteed, as I've pointed out. But moreover, even the empirical record suggests that bank monitoring by uninsured creditors is not particularly strong. Now, I choose to illustrate this by looking at a couple of different banks, which I'll come to shortly. So I acknowledge that moral hazard exists, but I do think that the case is overstated. But moreover, it doesn't follow that the way to cure instability arising from illiquidity or depositor flight is to limit deposit insurance. The point about 2008 and other crises is that it was the uninsured creditors who were supposed to be the active monitors, because that's what the model tells us. The model tells us that, well, if you grant deposit insurance, that reduces monitoring incentives, but anyone who's not insured, that gives them the monitoring incentives, because it's their, you know, if they've lent the bank money, they have incentives to monitor what the bank is doing. But it was the uninsured creditors, if you look at the empirical record, certainly in the examples I'm going to give, which demonstrates that uninsured creditors didn't do so. And you've got to remember that most bank creditors are not depositors. in the model that we have now. They are wholesale funders. They're big corporations. They are other banks. They're other financial institutions. So the idea that deposit insurance is about, you know, people with, I don't know, limited savings in a particular bank, and they're supposed to monitor that bank's activities, is very limited. It's about large corporations, and the theory tells us that those large corporations, large institutional cash pools, should monitor what banks are doing, but they don't. So the rationale for limiting deposit insurance in that sense, in my view, is limited. Moreover, if you remove deposit insurance caps, there are significant financial stability benefits. Because, as I pointed out at the beginning, the major driver for the emergence of all of these shadow banking structures, which, as I'll point out if I've got time shortly in the presentation, are prevalent in the UK and European Union almost to the same degree as they are in the United States. They arose because of legal changes which limited the safety of banks and retail banks and bank deposits. And I'll present you with some facts on that shortly. So let's first of all think about the evidence for moral hazard. I'll just point out now that even authors who claim that deposit insurance creates moral hazard, and these authors in particular have been, certainly the Mergage Kunt is at the World Bank and has been publishing on this for many years, so 15 years at least. They argue that in a strong institutional structure, deposit insurance may not lead to additional instability, even though the moral hazard argument will always arise. In countries with strong institutional structures, because the central bank monitors banking institutions, or in theory does, regulators can more effectively offset moral hazard. But let's assume that let's think about moral hazard for a moment. So there have been many studies which argue that the predictive qualities of subordinated debt yield spreads, in other words, uninsured creditors, and equity-based market indicators such as distance to default, all found that equity market indicators provide more value far from default, whereas yield spreads have a tendency to react close to default. In other words, you know, the argument goes that moral hazard or uninsured creditors will actively monitor management to prevent them taking excessive risks, and they'll do so from a long way out to stop, once those excessive risks arise, once that risk-taking behaviour occurs, they will force management, they'll increase their rates of lending, in other words, and force management, they'll say, look, we can't lend to you at this rate anymore because you're taking too many risks and we're worried about our return and whether we'll get our money back. So we're going to impose upon you in loan covenants or bond covenants or whatever it is, restrictions to stop you taking this excessive risk. But all of the literature, or most of the literature, says that that does not happen over the long term. What happens is there's very little monitoring, there's very little change in behaviour, and then at the last minute, when it becomes clear that banks have taken too many risks, bondholders run, and that's what collapses the system. They don't monitor in the short term, or even the medium term. It's just at the point where the information comes to light that they should have been monitoring in the first place, that they run, and that causes financial instability. So if you think about Northern Rock debt yields, Northern Rock essentially collapsed in September of 2007. It was finally nationalised in February 2008, but it essentially collapsed on the 17th of September 2007. This is the subordinated debt spread on Northern Rock up until mid or around July. Within 6 weeks of this, we see here where the yields were. Or Northern Rock was famous, if you like, for the fact that it was using uninsured liabilities, it was using wholesale markets, it did not expand its depositor base. This was the whole point about the Run on the Rock parliamentary inquiry. They said you did not have stable funding in place because wholesale funders run, depositors generally don't. And even up until, as I say, July of 2007, 6 weeks before complete collapse, this was what subordinated debt yields, this is what lending prices did. Anyone lending to Northern Rock was lending less in July than it had been at the start of the year. So they weren't monitoring the business model. They just weren't. The credit default swap story tells, or charts tell a similar story. The monitoring was slightly better. As I said, this is an early stage paper, so I need to fathom out what happened here. But anyone buying credit default swap on Northern Rock bonds, essentially, apart from this spike here, it was a similar story. The market didn't stop Northern Rock allegedly taking these risks. That blows a big hole in the idea that uninsured creditors have an incentive to stop excessive risk-taking or a flawed funding model. And we can see here, of course, what happened. Credit default swaps, the market went to 70%, if you like, which means that they basically couldn't insure any liabilities. Same dynamic happened to a lesser degree with Bear Stearns. So Bear Stearns was the first major US casualty. Everyone thinks about Lehman Brothers, but I exclude Lehman Brothers and RBS from this analysis. They're the sort of poster children of bad banking now. Everyone talks about Lehman in the US and everyone talks about RBS in the UK. But the problem with analysing Lehman and RBS was that the central banks and treasuries had already stepped in to save Bear Stearns and Northern Rock. So analysing financial market dynamics in relation to Lehman and RBS, there's a problem there, because there was an expectation based upon what happened with Bear Stearns and Northern Rock that those institutions would also benefit from a guarantee or benefit from a government bailout, because these institutions had been bailed out, essentially. So if you look at Lehman's CDS prices, again, they don't move until September of 2008, when it collapsed and it actually failed. And in fact, they went down. The premiums went down. But as I say, it's hard to, the joint hypothesis problem, it's hard to divorce market expectations from what the government had already done. So Bear Stearns and Northern Rock are, in my view, the better examples. And again, Bear Stearns, they could borrow. They collapsed in March, and in February they could still borrow at the same rate as they could borrow earlier in the year. Uninsured creditors were not doing this the job. And if you extend this graph this way, the CDS price was almost identical for all of this time. They were not exerting the discipline that they showed under this moral hazard argument. Now, Stephen Schwartz of Duke has done published a paper in 2017 on this, Too Big to Fool. I think it's a fantastic paper. We had Professor Schwartz in Sheffield earlier in the year. And he argues that the case, and he's talking here about Too Big to Fail, not deposit insurance, but the arguments, in my view, are analogous. And he argues that the problem of too big to fail is exaggerated, and I would substitute that for the problem of uninsured liabilities is exaggerated, or insured liabilities, I should say. So he goes into some detail about whether risk-taking, which is supposed to emanate from this idea that bank liabilities are somehow insured, arises from the fact that insurance is in place, And he says, no. Most of the studies that purport to show this conflate causation with correlation. And whilst I don't agree with the conclusions in his paper, which are basically that we need to introduce more corporate governance reform to ensure that bank managers pursue a public interest as well as a private interest, I think the basics of his paper are very sound. And the point is, you know, he says here, there's no evidence that moral hazard is the cause of excessive corporate risk taken by systemically important firms. To the contrary, such firms are often so large and their actions so subject to scrutiny that they would have difficulty taking excessive risks in the exploitation of a bailout. They are, in the words of this article's title, too big to fool the public. So, I also talk about this, you know, he talks about other reasons large firms generally have economies of scale. This is why they can borrow cheaper. What he says is, all of the studies that purport that there's a too big to fail subsidy, in other words, too big to fail firms can borrow at lower rates than other firms, that indicates that there's an expectation that they'll be bailed out. And therefore the moral hazard argument is obliterated. And he says, no, that's not how it works. Large firms generally have economies of scale. They have better access to debt markets. That's why they're big. That's why the best people go to these firms in many respects. They get paid more to work for these firms because they're better than their competitors. They have better access to debt markets, more information, larger dividend payout ratios, and their credit is less vulnerable to market disruption. As I say, I don't agree with his solution to this, but it was very refreshing to read that paper and think, well, maybe the moral hazard arguments are not as strong as normally purported. I delved into this in an article this year in the Journal of Financial Regulation. I'm not going to go into it now, but it highlights the example of securitization and the reforms since 2008 to supposedly increase the stability of the securitization process to remove this so-called moral hazard dimension. It falls down on so many levels. You know, the idea was that these financial institutions were creating these securities and then foisting them off on unsuspecting buyers. That's one strand anyway. And that's been a strand throughout the literature. It was moral hazard. They didn't care which, you've probably all heard this story, they didn't care which loans they were originating because they knew they could securitize them and pass them off to someone else. So they gained fees for originating the assets and securitizing them. And then they passed them off to someone else, you know, the so-called greater fool in the chain argument. But that's not what happened. Look at the retention of mortgage-backed securities from some of the largest financial institutions. Look at just one example, Merrill Lynch. 91% of the volume of mortgage-backed security transactions that they were involved of the mortgage-backed securities that they were associated with, 91% they retained. They didn't get rid of them. So it wasn't like passing this hot potato down the chain. They kept them on balance sheet. That's completely inconsistent with the moral hazard argument. And that's something that I'll go into in much greater detail in the paper when it's finally written. Goldman Sachs, the smartest guys in the room, smartest people in the room, I should say, 70%, they kept on balance sheet. They might not have been their mortgage-backed securities, but of the volumes that they were associated with, 70% they kept on their balance sheet. And you know, there are other arguments where, you know, you can say, well, they bought protection from AIG against these falling, you know, the values of these falling, so they thought that they were hedged. Okay, fine, but it's still inconsistent with the view that this was, you know, all about moral hazard. So, coming on to the benefit to my proposal, I'm not going to have time to go into the competing proposals because there are many. So we have an end to bank runs. If you have guaranteed deposit insurance, we have an end to bank runs and reduction in financial system instability. It guarantees the payment system. You'll have cheaper loan funding for consumers if you've got the state Well, the central bank standing behind bank liabilities, you know, that cheapens their source of funding, so they should be able to pass those savings on to consumers. We simplify financial regulation massively. We've seen in relation to bail-in and deposit seizures in the Eurozone following the, the European Union, I should say, following the Bank Resolution and Recovery Directive, the real problems that's caused. But the main one that I want to focus on is the compression of non-bank credit intermediation, i.e. a reduction in the need for shadow banking. And also it reduces pressure for government deficits to supply safe assets to the financial system. Because in the literature, at least, there have been a lot of suggestions, not just Pozanov, but loads of suggestions that governments need to keep issuing treasuries, keep deficit spending to satisfy financial institutions' requirement for safety, because there are no other sources of safety out there, especially because of the limitations placed on bank insurance, bank deposit insurance. Now, I've got no problems with government deficits. I think government deficits are good things in themselves, if required. But I don't think a good reason for a government deficit is to satisfy financial institutions' requirements for a safe asset. So this safe asset argument, we go through many different examples of economists in general arguing that the reason that the shadow banking system emerged was as a source of a constant supply of safe assets, which were not treasuries and were not bank deposits, because bank deposits are not guaranteed beyond a certain level. You think about Apple's cash pile. You've got Apple Corp. I know its shares have dived the last few days. You think about Apple Corp. It's got billions, hundreds of billions in cash. What is it supposed to do with that cash? It can't put it in the banking system because it's not insured. So where does it go? It goes to money managers. And those money managers place it in all of these different shadow banking infrastructures that pop up everywhere and are highly unregulated. And they leverage that cash for returns. My argument is to put it in the banking system. If we abolish caps on deposit limits, you can put it in the banking system. And most of the literature says the same thing. We learned during the financial crisis, with the shortage of government bonds, private agents relied on privately produced safe assets. They read mortgage-backed securities, CDOs, all the other varieties of financial asset that were created by the shadow banking system, because there was no alternative of safety. There were no bank deposits available because they weren't insured. Mortgage-backed securities and others are collateralized by loans, so at least there's some margin of safety there. But they were created in response to the shortage, and the entire literature says the same thing. That's where the shadow banking system arose from legal change, which limited deposit insurance and limited interest paid on deposit accounts in response to the depression. This is another chart which said, what is the driver of shadow banking? What's the major driver of shadow banking? This is from the IMF, I think, or the World Bank. What is the major driver of shadow banking? It's institutional investor growth. It's all of these pools of cash funds which need somewhere safe to put their cash. Where do they put it? They put it in securitizations, they put it in the repo market, etc. I've got lots of other stuff on this. These shortages are not going away. The shortage of safe assets is going to continue. The shadow banking system is not shrinking materially. Okay, so why support commercial versus shadow bank production of claims? And here is where I draw on Hockett and Omarova, who published this seminal paper last year called The Finance Franchise. And my view, in common with them, is that the banking system is an extension of the state. It's a franchise agreement. And what they argue in a very long paper, but fantastic paper, is that the banking system relies upon the full faith and credit of the sovereign. Unlike the shadow banking system, because most of the time, the shadow banking system does not fulfill, well, most of the time it's probably too strong, but often does not fulfill any public purpose. It supports secondary markets, which are basically not casinos, but as close to casinos as you can get in regulated markets. It's a zero-sum game. They don't drive productive enterprise, and they're largely unregulated. So that's where I derive this view that the retail banking system ought to be afforded a more privileged position. Now, there are drawbacks to this proposal. So there will be an impact on the treasuries and gilt market. Why would an institutional investor invest in a gilt as opposed to a bank deposit? They'll go for the bank deposit if it's guaranteed by government, possibly. But my view is that, well, hang on, why do investors invest in gilts? Not simply because of safety, but they want yield. Bank deposits will not give yield. Gilts will. So I think that the argument that this will destroy the gilt market is wide of the mark. There is some contingent cost to government, but as I said earlier, I think that implicit and explicit guarantees are already there on the government's balance sheet, just waiting to be realised. There might be some impact on bank credit intermediation, etc., etc. I'm conscious of time. I think that what I'll finish with is that any institution of wholesale or widespread guarantees of bank liabilities has to go hand in hand with restrictions on the other side of their balance sheet. Remember the first slide the slide I started with basically said that market discipline is not the place, or the liability side of banks is not the place for market discipline. So you have to discipline the other side. So you have to say there are certain activities that banks, retail banks, which benefit from this guarantee, cannot undertake. Some of this has been introduced under the so-called ring fencing legislation. To me, they're too wide. So for securitisation, for example, remains permitted. You can still securitise if you're a ring-fenced bank, ostensibly because it guarantees cheaper funding. So the literature says there's two reasons for securitisation: cheaper funding and capital economisation. It's cheaper to securitise in terms of capital. Well, we need to get rid of that, because that should not be the function of securitisation. The other reason is fine. The other reason is legitimate, that it cheapens your funding. But if you've got guaranteed funding, you don't need to securitise. So securitisation should be taken off the table for any ring-fenced bank. Bank assets should also be held to maturity where feasible. This means that bank assets should not be marked to market. That was a big issue in 2008. And encourages modelling of high asset prices and leads to pro-cyclicality. Higher capital requirements. Again, the literature is full of this, and I still don't see the rationale for not forcing banks to hold even more capital. All of these devices such as TLAC, you know, total loss absorbing capacity, bail-in, all of this is nonsense. You need strong tier one capital, and that's what Ad Marty and Helwig have been pushing for, so it's Goodhart. And I suppose the biggest issue is the expansion of macroprudential oversight, monitoring banks, see what they're doing, etc. But I'll have to finish there. Sorry, I've run out of time. Sorry, Mark.